Thank you for downloading this podcast from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
And as always, I want to thank the Pardes Institute, pards.org.il, for helping to make this class happen. Hi, everybody. Good morning.
Good morning.
It's good to see some familiar faces and some new faces. I just want to give a little context because those of us that have been together since the beginning of the year, we're making a little jump. And those of you who haven't been here since the beginning of the year shouldn't be too nervous because I'm not assuming that you know the entirety of Jewish history. Or if I do, you'll forgive me. So where are we now? What we're going to do in the next five classes is map out a little bit of the encounter between the Jewish story and modernity. So in order to do that, we've jumped over a rather critical 200 years of Jewish history, what the secular historians call early modernity. And it's actually, if you're in the history know, it's getting more and more attention as a separate time period among secular historians and Jewish historians. We will come back to that next year. It's a little plug for the CE continuing saga of the Jewish story that I will pick up, those of you who are concerned, right where we left off last year, which is at the expulsion from Spain for the story of Sephardic Jewry and with the entry, the birth, really, of Polish Jewry at the turn of the 16th century with Ashkenazi Jewry, and we will keep that story going, which means we're probably going to encounter, once again, much of what we're going to speak about now. That aside, what's the goal for these five classes? I want to start with a little bit of the backstory today to understand what is the what are the critical components of the encounter between the Jewish story and modernity? I'll explain what that means momentarily. And as part of that, I want to fill in some of the story of Shabtai Tzvi and Baruch Spinoza. Right? And then going forward, my goal will be to lay out a little bit of the understanding of the Jewish Enlightenment in its roots in what's known as the Berlin Enlightenment. We will have to see it flow over into Eastern Europe in the encounter with socialism and some other sort of like broader world philosophies. We're going to have to talk about the birth of the Reform Movement and the splintering of what was considered to be sort of normative religious community. And then depending on how far we get, we might even get to what are known as the heralders of Zion, the sort of pre-Zionist thinkers. I'm not going to go into Zionism in this class. I made a decision you have to stop somewhere. It's only five classes. I'd rather do less and get more of an intensive look than try to just do some broad sweep because it's always a tempt to come back for more. And before I move on, you should know that those of you who want to catch up on the last, 2,000 years of history? 1,500? That we did in this year. You can find all of this year's classes are recorded. They are on Pardes' digital platform. It's called Elmad. You can find my faculty page there, and you'll see them all. If people have questions about that, I'm happy to speak about it after the class. And that being said, any logistical questions before we get underway? Great. So you can try to stop me somewhere in the middle if you need to. Okay, so what is modernity? We spent actually a lot of time last semester speaking about the problems of periodization in history. Periodization, this desire that historians and intellectuals have to break up time into manageable chunks. And we spoke about the fact that what I mean, like the modern period, as opposed to what? What comes before the modern period? The pre-modern, that's easy. You caught me there, right? No, so early modern is a relatively, postmodern concept. We get really confused here, right? But meaning medieval, the middle, this idea that there was the Middle Ages, that there was late antiquity, that there was antiquity, that there are these time periods into which we can break what is essentially an undifferentiated flow of time, right? No one ever woke up in the morning and said, oh, thank God it's modernity, right? So there's no point at which you can actually draw that line. And we spoke about the fact that, in particular, if you want to do it, you have to say, in terms of what? In terms of art and culture? In terms of political development? In terms of religious thought? Also geographically? For various reasons, modernity will begin in some places before it begins in others. It hasn't even reached some of them yet. If you've been in certain neighborhoods here in Jerusalem, you know that the Middle Ages are alive and well, right? So aside from the sort of difficulties of using such an intellectual construct, we always have to remember there's a value that lies behind it. Now, there is no neutral breaking up of time. And it's not just a utilitarian approach, which is, it's useful to be able to speak about a chunk of time as the medieval period. But there's always a value which underlies it. And the easiest way to demonstrate that is just to simply ask you, would you rather have someone call you modern or medieval? Right? Although you should know that the Middle Ages is making a comeback intellectually. Right? This sort of presentation of people have encountered this out there. Presentation of the Middle Ages as a time of great sort of pluralism and religious tolerance. Yeah, I know. It sounds like a hard sell. I know, but you would be surprised. There's medievalists out there who are like having a comeback in their careers. Who thought such a thing could happen? But so what I want to do is just touch a few points of the sort of classic secular historical view of what modernity is. And then I want to present to you my own personal view of how to understand it within the context of the Jewish story. So what's modernity? First of all, probably the most characteristic aspect of modernity is reason over faith. Or we're going to have an increasing rise of this sense that the human being is a rational creature, that our fundamental capacity to know the truth depends not upon religious faith and inherited tradition, but rather upon our intellectual capacity to know, right? And that will come together with breaking the bonds of tradition, right? I'd say that there's a sort of a breaking of bonds of tradition to free the reason, and there's an expansion of the horizons of thought. That's what I want you to think about. You know, the first one I would characterize, if people are familiar, that Galileo Galilei is condemned by the Catholic Church for heresy. I think it's in 1633. It's more or less. It might not be the exact year. You can check it out in Google if you really want. But functionally, it's right at the kind of the beginning of where we're going to start our story. What's Galileo condemned for? Heliocentrism. Saying that indeed Copernicus was correct. And not only that he was correct, because Copernicus, of course, was an observational astronomer. He didn't really have the tools that Galileo developed. He was essentially proving that Copernicus was correct. It's a strange thing to condemn someone for heresy to make an observation about astronomy. And that's because the church at the time was wedded to what's known as Ptolemaic astronomy. It's an astronomy which they inherited from antiquity, late antiquity, technically speaking. But what really matters is the church and all traditions, including Am Yisrael, by the way, I want to leave us out of that, were insistent upon a worldview which says, tell me what you believe, and then I'll tell you what you know. Right? And Galileo wanted to do the exact opposite. He says, don't tell me what you believe. Look into the telescope and tell me what you see. Right? That's what's known as empiricism. Right? And that is what I mean by breaking the chains that tradition held on knowledge. Right? There's a very powerful tendency. We're all familiar with the, if I hadn't have seen it, I wouldn't have believed it. That's the empiricist's approach. But are you aware that before such a phrase was ever used, the opposite was true? Is if I hadn't have believed it, I wouldn't have seen it. Right, which is also true. That's the postmodern issue that perhaps we'll get to later on. But I just want you to picture one half of the intellectual revolution of modernity, which Am Yisrael will be subject to just as much as everybody else, is look into the telescope. Don't tell me what you believe. Tell me what you see, and then we'll work out what to believe. That's one half. The other half is, as I said, yeah?
No, it's just problematic in some way.
Oh, it's very problematic, but it is the hallmark of modernity. And those of us who live, like it or not, in the postmodern world are already, recently we got some hesitations around the very sort of simplistic and almost fanatical belief in reason which will arise from that. But we're not there yet. In our story, it's a breath of fresh air because don't forget that tradition wasn't a neutral force. Tradition was bound up with the whole social structure, which is going to be another one of the characteristics of modernity, is the breaking of the religious and political structures, the hold of the church and the monarchy on European society will begin to crumble. This is what's known as democratization of society, small d, right? Democratization of society, and it's a slow process, still happening in the world now. But the idea being that once you uncouple knowledge from tradition, then traditional structures are weakened in their ability to control people's lives. When you put that together with the widening of the horizons of knowledge, which means what? First of all, the great age of exploration precedes our story. Right? The world is now a globe, officially. There's no longer maps, the edges of which say, thar be dragons. Right? There may be some blank spots there, but we have a sense of one world, which will be quite significant to our story going forward. Right? also mass literacy, right? We only encountered the printing press at the end of last semester. We spoke about it very briefly. But mass literacy is another way in which the horizons of thought expand. The average person's ability to know, right? Like when I say to you the word globe and where are you right now, most of us could probably intellectually locate ourselves on a globe because you have information. You've been exposed to the idea of countries and seas and continents, etc. But this type of information is only beginning to spread its way out into the world, and the impact is enormous. Another hallmark of modernity in the sort of general intellectual sphere. Together with this will be the rise of the individual. Truth is, we've been charting the rise of the individual. Anybody remember when I first made an argument to bring it up? Anybody who was in the last semester? So many people say the Black Plague, interestingly enough, in the mid-14th century, with the death of between the third and half of Europe's population, human labor became more valuable than your average cow. And suddenly you had a door open with many other factors to the rise of individualism, right? And the idea that the collective existence of humanity rests upon the individual. Again, that's existed since the first person opened their eyes and said, I'm me. I'm talking about a broad intellectual and social structure that could support the development of the individual. That will matter a lot for the Jewish story, because up until now, the Jews have lived, particularly in Europe, but in the rest of the world as well, within a collective identity. And the struggle between the collective identity of the Jewish people and the powers pulling at the individual are going to be a very big part of our story going forward. Right? The concept of citizenship goes with individuality, the idea that an individual actually has a representation vis-a-vis the state, and ultimately the rise of the nation state will be one of the characteristics of modernity. We will speak about that as well. Science and technology, I already mentioned. Urbanization is an important one. People think of the Jews as urban for good reasons. The Jews urbanized well before the vast majority of European population, also distributed through the Ottoman Empire as well. But in particular in Europe, they led the charge in urbanization. So that's kind of how those forces are what are characterized in the sort of secular academic world as some of the hallmarks of modernity. And they're going to be the context within which our story unfolds. Questions? Comments? So I want to shift the frame. I'm going to talk about the Jewish story. Now, I'm not going to do the entire introduction. If people are interested in knowing something about the sort of general intellectual framework on which my approach to Jewish history is based, you're welcome to send me an email. I'm happy to send you a podcast which lays out what I call the Pardes structure, right? The four-part structure of time and conscious development on which this is built. You can send me, I'll write up my email right now so I don't forget, because otherwise I probably will. And feel free, and as long as that's not my email, as long as I'm saying it, thank you. I have so many addresses, they all go to the same place. As long as I'm saying it, feedback is very precious to me, right? If you're here, that means you want to be here, which means you don't want to waste your time. If there's something which is happening that you don't want to be happening or something that's not happening which you would like to, please let me know. And if you're not sort of comfortable doing it in class or face-to-face, you can always reach me here. Yeah, Dove. Well, we've named some of them. I mean, this rise of information, the printing press, we're going to speak about two of the particular ones momentarily. You know, I mean, the deeper question I hear you asking is that those are I'm speaking about phenomena, not what created them. I mean, it's almost impossible to know. How is it that humanity at some point just got tired of being told what to do and wanted to figure it out for itself? I mean, if it were a child, we'd say we call that maturation. So maybe human society works the same way. Maybe it's a divine will unfolding. It's a little bit hard to know.
So the way that the individual must have felt, I'm guessing, in this explosion of information and access to thoughts that they never had before, and this whole kind of reorientation, if you will, or a different way of being in the world,
yep.
Outside, let's say, observing, where we're even there, where we stand and what the limits
What I would say is that some of the hallmarks of modernity, and as you're identifying the postmodern era as well, is an uprooting from the structures of knowledge, culture, and identity, which gave a sense of grounding to the individual and to the collective up until now, and we will speak at length about those powers.
Could you just repeat what you said about the Black Plague?
Yeah, the plague, by killing off a third to half of the population of Europe, made human labor far more valuable a commodity than it had been for quite some time in history. And doing so freed up individuals basically to stand vis-a-vis society as an individual as opposed to a mass of humanity of just basically slaves or serfs. It was one of the major factors that people identify. When does the individual begin to rise? It's interesting that around then is also when the novel first develops as a art form. Remember, individualism, as I said, exists as part of human experience. The question is, when does it become a widespread social phenomenon? Yes. So, I mean, it's a there's a certain iterative effect, right? You need a certain critical mass of literate people to make it a financially viable business to print, right? But one of the things you're doing by printing is also making it desirable to learn to read, right? And what we're going to see is that when we get to what's known as enlightened despotism, one of the really sort of transformative movements in government in Europe, that one of the hallmarks of modern state is what? Education. And not education in the way that sort of like John Dewey liberal American society thinks of it, which is education for the sake of the human being, but this is education for the sake of the state, right? That it is a very powerful tool of state to create widespread literacy. And we'll speak about why that is at another time, but you're correct in saying that Am Yisrael, on average, was far more literate than the world around it, which is why the Jews were involved in printing from basically day one, as we spoke about at the end of last semester. I can't go backwards. It's a myth. As far as I know, it's a myth.
It's a myth. And they blame the Jews for it.
They definitely blame the Jews, that's for sure. But it is, as far as I know, a myth that less Jews died. But they blamed us anyway. Don't worry. That's not a myth. Okay. So this class, in my mind, is an exploration of Jewish consciousness in its historical context. The Jews were, on average, more literate.
But not literate in the language of the country, necessarily.
Not necessarily so.
But literate in Jewish learning.
Correct. In both in Hebrew and in whatever Jewish vernacular was at usage. So Yiddish, Ladino, Judeo-Arabic. But once one sees the value of learning and reading, it's an easier jump to mastering another language, and in certain places, like in Spain, the Jews were heavily involved in creating the vernacular of Spanish. Okay. So as I said, the tagline, as it were, for this class is Jewish consciousness in its historical context. Right? Meaning what? Meaning I am interested in dates, names, and the events of history, but I believe that the unique characteristic of Jewish history is an unfolding consciousness which drives the way in which we respond to and shape the events around us. So we've been tracing a particular model of identity for quite some time. In fact, if people who've been together in the class since the time of Ezra and Shivat Zion and the return to Zion, so now I'm speaking about 500 years or so before the Common Era, right, you may remember that I made an argument that Ezra begins an era of an identity based on us and them. Right, it's an identity based on opposition. Now remember, opposition is not all negative. Because I think, as everybody would agree, whether it's good fences make good neighbors, or the very fact that separation is always the necessary precursor to relationship, right? You don't have a relationship with your own foot, you have a relationship with someone else. And if you've ever been in a relationship in which you start losing boundaries between one another, you know it doesn't go so well. Healthy relationships are built on clear boundaries. And we've been tracing a relationship model, an identity model for Am Yisrael, which has allowed us to both survive and thrive through exile. through a very clear sense of who we are and who we are not. And I'm not going to go review the history of that. You can go listen to the rest of the class. But it's important because together with that has come the rise of the halachic project. Right? This fascinating assumption on the behalf of the sages that God cares about everything and that we can know what God wants about any particular thing. And so therefore the halacha becomes a behavioral system for relating to the entire world. Right? It's a complex endeavor. But on the identity front, it meant that when we landed at the end of last class, really more or less in the Gaonic period it was solidified, but by the time we got to the end of last class, we had a one-to-one relationship between identity and law. People recall. What do I mean? The thing that we call Judaism. Right? This idea that a Jew is what a Jew does. And ipso facto, if you don't do what a Jew does, you're not a Jew. Now, of course, there have always been a diversity of practice, and there's always been people that show up in shul and people that don't, right? And et cetera, et cetera. But the assumption, by the time the Gaonic period was well underway, for almost another 1,000 years, was that there's a one-to-one identity between law and Jew. Right? And you see how that relates directly to this boundary, us and them. Because now I can see very clearly who is and who is not part of the collective. And it will get diverse, you know, because Spanish Jewry will look different than Polish Jewry, then will look different than North African Jewry. But if you scrape away the sociology and what we call in religious terminology, minhag, right, custom, you will still get to a core narrative and practice which is largely the same. That model itself is largely based on the boundaries of the permitted and the forbidden. Right? Meaning, how do you actually make distinctions? This we eat, that we don't. These people we marry, those we don't. These places we go, those we don't. Right? It's not the entirety of Jewish law, but it is a major force within it. I mean, we say it every Motzei Shabbat at Havdalah. Hamavdil ben kosh l'chol or l'choshech Yisrael amim yom ha-shvi'i v'sheshit yimei ha-maseh. Hamavdil, the one who divides. That division is a core identity characteristic of Am Yisrael all the way up until when? When does that division of us here and them there begin to break down? French Revolution, Enlightenment, Spain. In 1391, there was a wave of mass forced conversion in Spain. And what's known as the converso community emerges. Now, it's complex, and we spoke about some of it last year, but just to give you a small insight, for 100 years, these people were forcibly converted. Some of them also chose, as we spoke about, to become Catholic, and it's a complex story of the hidden and the revealed, the Catholic, but the practicing Jew who feels drawn toward Catholicism, someone who actually loses hope for any religion whatsoever and becomes what we would today call a philosoph, right? You add all that then to the expulsion 100 years later. And the bulk of the Jews during the expulsion went where? To Portugal, right? And in Portugal, the ones who had held out for 100 years, these were the Jews, the ones who had held out for 100 years against the church, against the state, everything, were then within 3 years, a little bit longer, I think 5 years, were then themselves mass converted. But that was more than Portugal could swallow. And what's born out of this is what we actually know as the converso consciousness. People who outwardly were Catholics, inwardly were Jews, but were alienated both practically and ideologically from the mainstream Jewish community. But this is complex. We're going to speak more about it as we go forward. But you know what happens there? We are them. It's not so easy anymore when what's called the nacio, the Portuguese-Hebrew nation, which plays a big role in the story which precedes this. I'm trying to give some of the backstory here, right? These are the Jews who founded the Jewish community in North America and largely South America as well. Right? The Jews that were involved were known as the port Jews, the merchant class who were spread out all over the world. And just imagine the Jewish community where some people are practicing what we would today call Orthodox Jews. Some people are what we would today call sort of like off the derech, you know, but you know, the shul they don't go to is Orthodox. And some people are Catholic monks. Because, yes, and everything in between. I'm not talking about now. I'm talking about the birth of a phenomenon and the breakdown of another. Because now this sort of simplistic identity of a one-to-one relationship between law and Jew and the very clear divisions between us and them, which had allowed Am Yisrael to cultivate an identity through time amongst the conversos at least, begins to crumble. Because it's just not so simple any longer. Not only that, but there's a tremendous nobility of purpose and courage of spirit amongst tens of thousands of Jews who are fighting for the slightest bit of their identity. I mean, the documentation, by the way, is worthwhile reading. The struggles of someone whose only sense of Jewish identity is the sort of anti-prayer they were taught to say when they took conversion, which was a declaration that what they were doing was an idolatrous act. In fact, we know that from some of the documentation that much of what many of the conversos knew about Judaism, they discovered from the Inquisition, from the trials of their neighbors. Well, I don't know what tefillin are, but I know it must be something Jewish because I heard the Inquisitor ask about that question over and over again. Right? This type of identity is, thank God, very far from our... Although if you speak to refuseniks, and Soviet Jewry had a sadly very similar experience in many ways. But the reason I bring it up now is that the sort of crumbling of the pre-modern identity of Am Yisrael really begins with Spain. And of course, that community is scattered to the four winds and becomes a global network. What's known really as the Nacio, because the Jews of Spain proper, very few actually survive. But the Jews that were forced into Portugal and then converted, they're the large bulk of what we know as the converso world, which, as you're pointing out, today is making a comeback in both in genetics and in culture, and so very interesting reasons for that, but I don't want to go to it now. So that's going to be a very important part of the story that we're telling, because, of course, the question comes then, what replaces it? We're going to see, even though that seems like it's the sort of Sephardic Jewry side of the story, that there's a parallel process that happens with the Ashkenazi world as the Enlightenment and secularism comes online. Because the converso consciousness basically boils down to this idea that outwardly I'm one thing and inwardly I'm another. And the question is, who creates what? Generally, the model is outwardly who creates my identity? Society, be it by force, the Catholic Church says you are now Catholic, or just be it by sort of social momentum. We're all from here, right? Right? Or, by the way, to go afuch al afuch, we're all secular, modern, rational people, aren't we? You couldn't possibly want to rebuild the temple. Right? That holding of an inner consciousness where you see the seat of your true identity is one of the hallmarks of not modernity, of what? Of post-modernity. That ultimately identity is an inner experience which cannot be defined by any collective construct. This is always true, by the way. You will always find the roots of the next phase within the most developed construct of the current one. So for Am Yisrael, I'm going to put it out as a question. We won't answer it yet, but we're going to do a lot of mapping it out today. This us and them model, which I want to encourage you with all of its challenges to realize is a very powerful model for survival and exile, the clarity of boundary, right? I mean, I'll tell you a quick story. That my brother, who was married to a Catholic woman for many years, I used to go visit them when they're in New York City, and I had a little portable kitchen. Come to their apartment, pop out my kitchen, we're hanging out, make dinner. It was great. We're all very good friends. So at a certain point, they came and visited me here in Israel. It happened to be Pesach. And I see his wife looking around my kitchen, very confused. And I said, what are you looking for? She said, well, where's that, like, little, you know, the thing that you do? Because she didn't know. And I realized, oh, my gosh, she thinks that's what Jews do. And I explained to her the idea of what it is to be a halachic astronaut. Right? That's what you are. You're a halachic astronaut. You can survive out there, but only with some rather extreme preparations, right? And so in many ways, Am Yisrael in exile cultivates this astronaut identity. We're here, we're getting by, but it's not our natural environment, right? And all those barriers between you and that corrosive atmosphere out there help you maintain life and certainly keep you separate. When was the last time an astronaut actually kissed the dust of the moon? Answer is never, right? Because it would be the kiss of death. But nevertheless, there is an alienation, which comes, of course, at a price. As we've saw, the history of the Jew as both the indigestible element, first of the Roman Empire, and then the obstinate refuser of Christian salvation, we will see in modernity that Jew will become the alien element of society. And we'll speak more about that as we go forward as well. So with the breakdown of these structures that kept the Jew as the Jew within Europe, will come both freedom and a challenge to identity. And this is not a mystery to any of you sitting here. We all know this story, all the stories of assimilation and cultural erosion and questions of intermarriage and questions of identity and like people say, who wants an identity that's based on me, not you anyway, and like I don't accept that in other places of the world. Why would I want it to be who I am? I want to say what I am, not what I'm not. All these very real questions are rooted in the transition to modernity. And so what we're going to have to see is, does a new model of identity emerge? And one of the things, of course, one of the hallmarks of the Jewish encounter with modernity will be the rise of what? Zionism. And if not Zionism, pre-Zionism. I mean, this idea that the solution to the problem of exile is go home, right? And it will be very interesting where that first gets its momentum from. We're going to see that today. So, in essence, aside from all these sort of critical facts that the secular world identifies, you know, the reason over faith, the rise of the individual, the model of citizenship, and ultimately the nation state, science, technology, you know, the uncoupling of tradition and knowledge and the widening of the horizons of thought, I will add to that the breakdown, gradual as it is, of the structures of us and them that have allowed Am Yisrael to have a clear identity within exile. You know, the converso, as we'll see, who escapes. Well, I'll leave that story, actually, for its proper place. So that's this model, and it's a question then for us, what will be the model of identity that Am Yisrael will take through modernity in its health and in its ill health? Every model has its costs and its benefits. And frankly, what can we learn from it now? I'm always interested in that. So questions and comments before we actually now get into the flow of the story. Okay. If it comes up, you can stop me along the way. So there are two very important historical events that are located in the year 1648. We'll come back to Descartes at a different point of the morning. One is the Treaty of Westphalia. The Treaty of Westphalia is the formal end of the 30 Years' War, which lasted how long? Yeah, as opposed to the 100 Years' War, which is a lot more, right? We can't go into the 30 Years' War. It is really not the context. No, we have the time. It's a very interesting story for the Jews in there as well, in the rise of what's known as the court Jew model within Europe, something which is alive and well in the United States even today. It wasn't a joke. What is the court Jew? The court Jew is the very deep relationship between traditional Judaism and absolute power, which you can trace from basically the 13th century onwards. It has always been safer for the Jews when power is concentrated in one set of hands. It's a multipolar world, and it's instability and the play of forces which offers the greatest threat. So laugh as you will, it deserves thought. So what Westphalia does is it ends the attempt to reconcile whether the German states will actually be Catholic or Protestant. Like, functionally speaking, it's about a lot of things, but there is no Germany at this point in European history yet, right? What there are the German states, a bunch of baronies and principalities and the Holy Roman Empire is in that mix, and it's a mess. Probably over 100 of them. I have no idea. I'm sure it's in my notes somewhere. Over 300, even better. That sounds even bigger. But the point being is that the Protestant Reformation began 140 years ago or so, 130 years ago, right? And so each of these little duchies and dukedoms and baronies and all that, counties, that's where a count lives, right? has been swearing its allegiance either to the Catholic Church or to some subset of Protestantism for the last 100 years. And the idea that a state has one religion, well, not states, that a kingdom has one religion is still the dominant model within Europe. That model has been around since Augustine. Augustine the Hippo in the 4th century wrote The Kingdom of God, and then this idea that church and state are a union has been the dominant model of Christian society since then. That model receives its formal end at Westphalia. The Treaty of Westphalia practically accepted the idea that, like I said, that the German states were no longer going to unite under either Catholicism or Protestantism, right? Which means that nevertheless you have Catholics and Protestants within each state. That's the key to understand this. So what are you going to do? You have two choices. Expel whoever loses, which is a tried and true method in Europe. The Jews know that. What's your other choice? Okay, fair enough. Killing and expelling are on the same spectrum. You can accept a non-uniform religious environment. I was looking for a multipolar Christianity. Right? And that's exactly what happens. But what the sort of historical phenomenon, which was surely not in the minds of those who signed the treaty, is that what they basically did was they accepted the existence of a state whose power transcends religion. They accepted the existence of a state whose power transcends religion. Right? Ferdinand and Isabella, back in 1492, were the Catholic monarchs. And France and Spain have been struggling for the last, 400 years, who is going to be the most Catholic kingdom of Europe. The assumption on everyone's mind was that the German states were going to be part of that struggle, but it would only be a question of whether they would be Catholic or Protestant. Westphalia, by accepting the fact that they would be neither, but nevertheless, to keep people from just killing each other was to empower the state to protect the rights of the individual, not the collective religious entity, implicitly accepted the idea that the state is more powerful than religion. Well, that is why many people actually will peg the Treaty of Westphalia as the beginning of modernity. It is also the beginning of what we know as the secular nation state, because it empowers the state infrastructure over and above the multinational, to borrow a term, nature of religion. Right? That's an important turning point, and just to give it a little bit of oomph, I'll just remind you that Max Weber, critical sociologist at the turn of the 20th century, defined the nation-state as an entity that has a monopoly on the legitimate use of force to maintain order. Right? Meaning it's not an ideological entity like any of the churches had been up until then, but rather was simply a monopoly, and what's the critical word in that phrase? I'll say it again. It's an entity that has a monopoly on the legitimate use of force to maintain order. What's the key word there? Yes. It's where subtly some sort of ideology must creep in. And the ideology of modernity is increasingly going to be the rights of the individual. That's what the Enlightenment will offer. A state today in modern democratic society, a state's legitimacy depends on its protection of the civil rights of individuals regardless of race, class, creed, or culture, right? And to the degree in which a state erodes the rights of the individual for any of those reasons, it's viewed by Western secular society as only quasi-democratic, an illegitimate state. We here in Israel hear a lot of this. But don't forget that that's a particular philosophy, which is a product also of 1,500 years of tribal warfare. I mean, when I was in grad school, I had a good friend who was from Mali, which is a country which has seen its fair share of chaos in post-colonial Africa. And she once was lamenting to me, why can't Africa be like Europe? And I said to her, because she had not learned so much of European history, and I said, well, you realize that they've... No, I said that's fine after 1,500 years of tribal warfare. And it was the fact that I called it tribal warfare, you saw the penny drop. Because, of course, she had encountered European history, but European history presents itself as a rational discourse of ideas. It's true every once in a while it got out of hand and we killed each other, but it's a rational development of ideas. No, it's not. It's tribal warfare, which, of course, is how Europeans speak about Africa, right? And so it is important to remember that one of the turning points in this tribal warfare is Westphalia. And practically for the Jews, the birth of multipolar Christianity and the rise of a state which is more powerful than religion, at first glance, looks like good news for the Jews. Well, we have no love lost for the church or for the major Protestant movements within Europe at this point, but stay tuned. Okay, so that's one piece here. Is there anything else I wanted out of Westphalia? No. The other piece that happens in 1648 is further to the east, right? In what's known as either the Khmelnytsky Uprising or the Khmelnytsky Massacres, depending on whether you ask the Ukrainians or the Jews, right? Khmelnytsky was a Cossack leader. I don't really want to get into the sort of the politics of it. Essentially, this was a large-scale revolt against the Polish nobility who ruled over what we now call Ukraine. Poland, throughout European history, has been much larger than it's been today. Also, it has disappeared for hundreds of years at a time. It's kind of a now you see it, now you don't type of country, which we should not make fun of. But for our story, it's critical that in around 1648, the Khmelnytsky, Bogdan, I can never say his name, Khmelnytsky, no matter how many times I practice, I can't say it. It's fine. This guy managed to unite the Cossacks in an effort, like I said, to throw off the Polish landowners who basically dominated what we now know as Ukraine, and indeed did succeed in creating a more or less independent Ukrainian entity. It wasn't a country. However, all the Polish landlords did not live in what they considered to be Eastern Poland, what we call Ukraine. They lived in the major cities of Poland. Who, however, was managing their estates out there in the hinterlands?
Jews.
The Jews. What are the Arendentors? I think that's how you pronounce it. Let me look at my note for a second here. Did I not write it down? Yeah. Arendators, right? Leaseholders. The idea being that the Pole doesn't care how the state is managed. The Pole cares that there's money in the bank. And the Jews, particularly through the liquor trade, which was one of the major money drivers of Eastern European Jewry culture, right, controlled a lot of the economics and actual land management in Eastern Poland / Ukraine, which meant that when it came time to throw the yoke of the Polish oppression off the backs of the noble Ukrainian people, who got the boot? The Jews. That may sound like a simplistic formation, but it's actually true in this case. Now, for our purposes for our story, because I'm trying to really fill in the backstory here, the devastation of these massacres cannot be understated. Now, Pinchas Mnat Lita, one of the community records of the town or the city, the country of Lita, states that at its meeting in 1650, the Council of Lithuania decreed 3 years of mourning. Right? Prohibitions on wearing elaborate clothes, jewelry, a declaration that no musical instrument be heard in all of Am Yisrael, not even at weddings for a full year. Right? The of Natan ben Moshe Hanover, who was a Jewish historian, Talmud, Kabbalist, wrote Yevin Mitzula, The Abyss of Despair. It's a great title. And he claims that there were 100,000 dead and 300 communities completely erased. Now, numbers are a tremendous game within history. Because if you go on Wikipedia, for instance, and follow the numbers of how many people died in this uprising, you will see that they're still changing on an almost monthly basis, oddly enough. Because there are two camps out there in the world, and you can probably guess who they are, Jews and Ukrainian nationalists. Because to Ukrainian nationalists, this is the beginning of their national existence. Remember, this is nationalism 101. This is when states in Europe begin. And therefore, to tie one's roots there gives an incredible legitimacy. And today, you know, the Ukraine, it's not a given, if you live in Russia, that Ukraine has any national rights. Right? So the struggle for Ukrainian nationalism, in its essence, doesn't have anything to do with the Jews. But to paint the roots of the national struggle as a mass slaughter of the Jews is not in your interest. So therefore, the numbers get downplayed. The Jews, well, we love our suffering today. Right? And it's important to us, sadly in my opinion, that our suffering be bigger than everybody else's. So therefore, you'll get a lot of Jewish, and hey, the Yevim Mitzula says 100,000 dead and 300 communities erased. Here you go, it's in black and white, right? So the numbers get larger and smaller and larger and smaller. But it's irrelevant to our story. What we really, if you want to understand the depth of the impact, Rav Shabtai Shechtel Horowitz, who was the son of the Holy Shelah. People are familiar with Shelah Kodesh, very important thinker. I can't teach everything, but whatever. Very important thinker. Wrote Shnei Luchot Abrit, which is why we call him the Shelah, right? He described 1948 as the third destruction. Sorry, whoops. 1648 as the third destruction that occurred in the year 408 of the sixth millennium, which was just the same as the first and second destruction. Now, that's a little bit chilling for those of us at this point who know the rest of European history. But that's the context that I want you to take. That no matter how many people actually died, this was a crushing blow to Eastern European Jewry. It's from here, really, that we see the beginning of the end of certain institutions, if you're familiar with what's known as the Council of the Four Lands, which was a tremendously highly organized, essentially internal government, both religious and sort of political, secular, that organized many of the Jews of Eastern Europe. It's also from here that the rabbinic class begins to totter and opens itself to the challenge of the rise of Hasidut, which in its origins, at least, is a grassroots movement, although it itself then becomes very institutionalized. We will speak, I haven't decided whether we're going to tell the story of Hasidut as part of this. I feel like I have to at the same time. I can't do everything, obviously not today. Although I am known to try, right? But more than anything else, both the massacres and Yevon Mitzula, the abyss of despair, represent the end of a process that really began with the Crusades. Right? Because we know back from our discussion of the Crusades that there is a martyrology culture within Ashkenaz. So if you recall, those of us were together last semester, we spoke about the power of martyrdom as a source of motivation, right? Bad long-term strategy for people as a whole, but very effective when small, highly motivated elements of society choose to sacrifice their lives for their ideals, because then the rest of the world can say, well, I don't want to die for that, but I am willing to live for it, right? So at this point, the scale, at least the perceived scale of the martyrdom, becomes crushing. And there's a creeping sense that I'm not really interested in living for this either. It's one of the reasons that Hasidut becomes so important in breathing hope and life into people's practice. But it's going to lay one of the planks for what will be the secularization of Jewish culture. Now, it's going to take a couple hundred years in Eastern Europe, but do not underestimate the blow here. Another piece I would say is that, you know, I told you guys last semester that the Crusades is when the smile went out of Ashkenaz, which I got a lot of people who could really relate to that. So if that was the case, I would say then the Khmelnytsky massacres is when Shvetzun Zayin Yid really became the motto. It's just hard to be a Jew. It's from this point forward that the characteristic poverty and sort of a descent in the power of rabbinic both leadership and learning, right, become much more symptomatic of Eastern European culture, and it's going to serve to set up the next phase of our story. Questions or comments on these two pieces of context, which play a very big role in at least European Jewry's counter with modern day.
Were Orthodox Christians.
Yes.
I don't know,
yes.
I guess it was a combination of things. Certainly, from a religious viewpoint.
Religious, economic, national, you name it.
Okay.
But again, I don't want to do too much of analysis on it because I'm trying to set the context.
Your comment about the hero as their hero. When I was in Kiev, I was walking along the streets at something. I look up and I see the sign on the street. And I have my little Cyrillic Latin turn over. Hetman Bogdan Khmelnytsky, the main street of Kiev.
Sure. Which, I mean, listen.
Are
very through you, but you have to be able to see things through the eyes of the people who are walking that street most of the time, and most of them aren't Jews. Oh, sorry, there's two people in line here, but no, go ahead.
You're saying that these were wealthier Jews then because they were managing the state.
Yes, but they also allowed the mass of Jews to live safely distributed amongst. Sure, yeah, more wealth and more power.
It
wasn't just that they couldn't reach the noblemen, that the Jews were the immediate expression of the power of the nobleman. They were the ones collecting the taxes. They were the ones enforcing the laws. They were the ones, you know, sort of like, you know, serving the liquor and taking the money.
And they were right there.
Yeah, and they were there. They were actually living right there.
And they weren't so beloved anyway.
Right, and as Alan was pointing out, there's the, you know, the religious element of the hatred was very easy to inflame.
So they took the land, like the Ukrainian peasants took over the land?
Okay, like I said, I don't want to go into the details. I'm not really prepared to get... The key here is I want you to see this in the way that the Shelah's son described it, a third destruction, because it's going to play a very important role in the story I actually do want to tell.
One thing that I couldn't understand was about the martyrdom, and is other people saying, you know, I don't want to die for this, I don't
want to... At a certain point, the inspiration that the martyrdom of the Crusades provided, as we spoke about, like as a sort of a crystallization of the rabbinic class, right? The repeated blows, and the scale in particular at this point, we've traced, and we've been together now for this whole year and plus, right? We traced the sort of march eastward from the Rhineland to the Ukraine, which is, you know, we're only getting a little further east into the Russian Empire. We don't go much further east than that until the Mir Yeshiva gets to Shanghai, right? That march has seen an increasingly harsh, we saw the Hussite Wars, right? We had the Black Plague. We've had another couple of crusades in there as well, right? And this sense that dying for the sake of God is a losing proposition, right? And in particular, just to remind you guys, this hallmark of rabbinic historical philosophy, mipnei chataeinu galinu me'artzeinu, that because of our sins we were exiled from our land, which in the liturgy, when we say it on Pesach, right? Every musaf. We say, now, remember, in the rabbinic mind, I see some sort of unhappy looks out there with that. In the rabbinic mind, this is a statement of historical agency. Right? Because of our sins, we were exiled from our land. The Romans didn't throw us out of our land and destroy the temple. We destroyed the temple through our actions. Right? And therefore, even though we lack all the classic platforms for historical agency, we don't have a state, we don't have an army, we don't have an economy, nevertheless, we will be able to re-enter history through what? Through our merits, through tshuva, right? If our sins got us thrown out of the land, then our good deeds, our mitzvot, will get us back. And it's a way of maintaining historical agency. The problem is, by the time the 17th century rolls around, and the third destruction, as the son of the Shelah calls it, is so devastating, at a certain point, and we spoke about how it really began to switch even back in the Crusades, that mipnei chataeinu galinu me'artzeinu is no longer a statement of historical agency, but becomes a burden of guilt. It must be that we did something really horrible, because otherwise, really? Really? We're still, like, what could we possibly, and of course, when does that entire philosophy collapse? In Auschwitz. Because who would open their mouth right now and say, well, it was because of our sins? There are people who do. There are people who do. And by the way, they're consistent with the history of Jewish thought from basically Ki Tavoh onwards. But why do people react so viscerally against that? Because, right or wrong, it's disempowering. It's disempowering. So really, like, what on earth could we have done to deserve that? And how on earth could we have actually stopped it? Which is why the postmodern Jewish culture is bound up with the re-empowerment of the state of Israel. But that's a discussion for another time. You guys can tune into the third season of Jewish Story, right? It's coming out weekly now. But for now, what we've done is laid the groundwork to understand a really important event, series of events in Jewish history, which is the false messianic movement of Shabtai Tzvi. So, you know, if you look... Well, actually, let me tell the story and then we'll do the analysis. So, Shabtai Tzvi is born in 1626 in Izmir. It's Ottoman-ruled Greece at that point. A thriving city. Legend has come down to us that he was born on what day? The 9th of Av, of course, because that's when the Messiah is meant to be born. Now, he seems to have taken very quickly to the mythic worldview of the Zohar that we spoke about at length last semester, and what he encountered of the new Torah coming out of Tzfat, the Torah of the Arizal. Now, this is one of the critical elements that lie well behind the story of early modernity that we've skipped, but it's critical to say at least just 2 minutes on the impact of the Torah of the Arizal. The Arizal Rav Yitzchak Ashkenazi, was in Sfat from the years 1570 to 1572. It was only 2 years that he was revealed as a teacher. He wrote almost nothing down. Everything that we have, not everything, but almost everything we have from him comes from his students, in particular of Chaim Vital. And nevertheless, his thought revolutionized first the mystics and then, more or less, the rest of Am Yisrael. It is hard to overstate the impact of the thought of the Arizal. Why that is, if you really want to know, we're going to have to come next semester when we actually discuss early modernity in its proper way. But what I want you to know now is that the critical element, two elements really, of his thought that contributed was, first of all, the Arizal was part of a larger movement toward returning experience as a legitimate source of authority. Right? Up until this point in Jewish society, tradition is the primary source of authority. We do what we do because it's what we've always done, and if there's going to be any innovation, it will be within the construct of halakha, which as a legal system is representative of authority. I mean, it's a traditional legal system, power of precedent, right? The sort of the what's called the above board give and take of analysis, and you know, think of a yeshiva and people poring over texts, and you know, that's the way we do things. But there's always been a subculture within Am Yisrael, we spoke about it at length last semester, of the Torah Hanistar, the hidden Torah. Mystics, right? And their source of authority, the answer to a higher authority, as we say, right, is in particular amongst those mystics what we call the prophetic Kabbalah, a term that really originates with Rav Avram Avulafia, but we can trace it through a very indirect line right to the Arizal. Right? And the Arizal is part of a larger movement of returning experience to a source of legitimate authority. Because he, when he would come out of his meditative states, would tell his students tremendous insights about creation, sometimes even making halachic assertions against the grain. Now, he was also a master of the revealed Torah. He wasn't just getting visions, right? But the weight of authority that was given to his words is hard to comprehend. And it's a hallmark of modernity, right? Empiricists say, don't tell me your traditional explanation. Tell me what you see. And it's a little bit strange, but oftentimes an ecstatic mystic belongs to the empiricist tradition. We may not think of that as empirical experience, but leave aside the intellectual skepticism that most secular Westerners or those of us who are trained in secular Western culture have about mystical experience, and just realize that if I say to you, yes, I just heard God or the angels tell me X, Y, Z, that's an empirical assertion. It's not based on rational systems of thought. It's like, I heard it. You'll either take it or leave it, right? And that is indeed one of the powers, because it's the empowerment of the individual, again, that uncoupling of knowledge from tradition. That's one piece, and his impact in that respect cannot be underrated. The other piece is a very specific teaching that the Arizal had, which is this idea of tikkun. Now, tikkun has gotten a lot of reworkings, and it existed before the Arizal, right? But in essence, his doctrine of tikkun bespeaks a larger, what I would call, empowered messianism. The idea that the human being, and it's rooted in the Zohar, the idea that the human being plays an active role in the unfolding of redemption. And not just Am Yisrael as a whole, but the individual in particular, if people are familiar with the kavanot of the Arizal, this idea that you have to have a certain meditative intention when you do an action, that what you're doing is, in that oh-so-incomprehensible language of the academics, you're completing the Godhead. I don't really know what that meant. But the idea being that God's will cannot find full expression within creation without human action. And on some level, that means, you know what you could be? The Messiah. Well, if your action could actually bring redemption to fruition, that means you can be the Messiah. Now, that's a wonderful idea if it motivates me to like do mitzvot and especially pushing against the grain of culture and the difficulty of being a Jew, etc. You can understand why that would be power. But what if I actually get the full notion that I am the Messiah? And I combine that with this notion that my experience is a legitimate source of authority. And I combine that with a charismatic, highly unbalanced personality. You know what I get? Shabtai Tzvi. So Chabad Tzvi had absorbed, like I said, the Zohar and the Torah sort of radiating out of Sfat at this time. He had a compelling voice. He was good-looking, charismatic. He gathered, even before he left yeshiva, a circle of admiring followers around him. He also, from the evidence, his early life was marked by what we would call manic depressive behavior, bipolar. This is what we call it today, right? Meaning the sort of periods of depression, heights of exaltation, but also significant times of calm, right? And so what seemed to have pushed the boundaries of his communal life in Izmir was this burning desire he had to pronounce the four-letter name of God, which is like the biggest sort of victimless crime, so to speak, that a Jew can do, right? They're like, unless you consider God the victim there. And at some point, he started telling his followers he was the Messiah and stood up in shul, of course, goes the story, and declared the divine name when he's saying the blessing of the city. Can you imagine the gabbai, the horror? They called him up for an aliyah, and he declares the four-lettered name of God in shul. And it's like, what? What did he just say? So he gets somewhere between 1651 and 1654. He's driven out of Izmir. The story goes because of that act. He moves on to Salonika, major Jewish city, which it will be then for another couple of hundred years, and quickly, once again, gathers a circle of friends and admirers. This stay also ends in disaster when, according to story, in one of his manic states, he celebrated a wedding under the chuppah with a Torah scroll. Right? This is the type of eccentric behavior. What? He married a Torah scroll, yes. Right? Now, you may have heard other versions of this story, some of them sort of like sexually lurid, and I want you to be aware of something. When we speak about Shabtai Tzvi, you have to peel away two layers, which are actually really the same thing. One is the layer of the incredible shame that the rabbinic establishment felt that a vast majority did nothing to oppose him, and a significant minority, and perhaps some scholars say majority, were active supporters, or at least enthusiasts. So like that shame, as we all know, when we're ashamed of something, it really helps to just blacken the name of whatever it was, number one. Number two, there's a later movement that we'll speak about as we go forward, known as the Frankists, who themselves were actually deeply involved in sort of orgiastic, very sort of strange sexual practices. So that gets projected back on Shabtai Tzvi. It's not certain that he indeed did do these things, but what is certain is that he is expelled from Salonika for that act, and he moves on then to Constantinople. He's working his way through the Ottoman Empire. Here, he actually began preaching the abolition of the commandments. And he coined a blasphemous blessing, which in many ways is the crystallization of his philosophy, is that he, blessed are you, O Lord our God, King of the universe, ha matir, what comes next, matir? We say ha matir asurim, which means releases the bound. But he said ha matir isurim, who permits the forbidden. Now, it's a nice turn of phrase, first of all, you got to give credit, right? But I want you to appreciate the depth. Because one of the questions that historians have is, how is it possible that Shabtai Tzvi's teaching, which to us today seems, let's just say, unbalanced, spread like wildfire throughout all of Am Yisrael? So part of it I've already given, the desperation, not just, I mean, listen, Sephardic Jewry was still recovering, lest you think that 1492 was so long ago, right? Number one, and Ashkenazi Jewry is I mean, by the way, the woman he eventually marries, the bride of the Messiah, is an orphan child rescued from the wreckage of the massacres, right? So that's part of it. People need, they need, and his charismatic brand, redemptive excitement was quite appealing, right? There's another very important piece. To whom would it make perfect sense to transform the phrase, he unbinds the bound, to he permits the forbidden? To what class of people that we've already discussed? Okay. The conversos. It makes perfect sense because it's completely expressive of who they are. Because they're bound in this Catholic identity and it's forbidden. But what he's telling people is, no, all those commandments you're worried about that defined your identity now, that's over. That period, and not only that, not only is it over, but as we're going to see shortly, it's indicative of the end of the process of exile. This is as far as exile goes, isn't it? When you become them. It's a natural conclusion to exile. And once you've gotten as far into the darkness as you could go, then you're going to lift up the most precious sparks, right? The Arizal says that all of life is about finding those divine sparks and through our conscious actions, lifting them up in this process of tikkun, of fixing the world. And where the brightest sparks fall? To the darkest places. So the things that are asur, that are bound, that are forbidden, only the Messiah could go all the way into the darkness and release those particular sparks. This all sounds very exciting, doesn't it? Maybe not to you, but if you're actually stuck in that world, you don't know if you're a Jew or a Catholic. You don't know what's forbidden and permitted any longer. And along comes someone and tells you, you are the indication that redemption is upon us, and I am the Messiah. That's going to be a very appealing message. Right? The number is less significant than the role in which they play. Because the other thing that we have to ask is, how on earth does the entire Jewish world, he begins this process in, like I said, in Salonika, let's give it 1652, you know? By 1666, it's over, or his particular role in it is over, right? That's less than 15 years. How is it possible that more or less the entire Jewish world not only knows, but a large part of it is like pecking their bags? You know, when I asked, and it wasn't me actually, one of my classmates asked Rabbi Bravender when I was back in yeshiva at this point, going on almost 20 years ago, we asked him about the messianic movement within Chabad and whether it was permissible to just keep, you know, stay involved with Chabad. And he said, they don't really believe the Rebbe was Messiah. We said, I don't know. I mean, I've met some Chabadnikim that were pretty serious about it. He looked at us. He was pretty angry. He said, when Shabtai Tzvi came, people sold their houses, they bought wagons, and they started to walk and take ships to the land of Israel. Just because this guy wants to dance around in shul, ay, 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 Mashiach, if he gets up in the morning on Sunday and goes to work, I'm not worried about it. Right? So you have to ask the question. Yeah, if you know Rabbi Bravender, by the way, it's perfect. Right? God bless, you should be healthy and well. The power of this movement and its dispersion depended on, first of all, modernity, the increase in transportation and communication technology. Right? Second of all, you know who will become the greatest enthusiasts? Converso merchants. Right? The city of Amsterdam, almost overnight, becomes a hotbed of Sabbatean enthusiasm. They're printing different tracts of his thought. And by the way, once you see the Sabbatean models of this idea of reaching into the darkness and liberating the light, you can see them everywhere. You can see them everywhere in Kabbalistic thought. This is not a foreign, in the same way many people struggle with the Trinitarian thought, which you can find also within certain Kabbalistic literature. Right? Why? Because things are rooted in basic elements of human psychology. I'll prove it to you. You know what the whole Trinity is based on? Not to start preaching Christianity, God forbid. But you know what it's based on? It's based on a model of all relationships. In every relationship, there are three. There's me, there's you, and there's our relationship. And if you think about the nature of power dynamic, who's the Father, who's the Son, and where's the Spirit between us? Right? That's a very powerful appeal. Because it, even though the theology of it may sound strange to you, the interpersonal psychological dynamic of it is very familiar. And when I begin to speak it to you, it will strike chords without you even knowing. So in the same way, Shabtai Tzvi's movement rides upon what is a increasingly widespread knowledge base of the Arizal in particular, although there's people that contest. Gershom Shalom, great scholar of Jewish mysticism, claims that it was Lurianic Kabbalah that led to this revolution. His Moshe Idel, one of his chief students, right, completely devastates Shalom's thesis, but nevertheless, it's clearly a factor. The other factor of sort of this crushing wound and depressed state, which Shabtai Tzvi manages to breathe hope and life. And don't forget, this is the other insight that Shalom has, that the difference between messianic hope and messianism is the difference between the ability to get up in the morning and the desire to quit your job. You understand? Like, hope is a very important ingredient in life. But too much of it can become poisonous, right? We want the Messiah? Of course we do. We want the Messiah now? Where's the emphasis? Messiah or now? In the same way, you know, peace now, peace for sure. Right now, I don't know. Is this the right time? Are you willing to sacrifice the notion of a durable peace for the notion of now? By the way, the flip side is true as well. If you don't really want peace, it's very easy to dismiss the now part because there is a time for these things, right? So that's the challenge. In the same way, Messiah now. What if, you know the famous story that the Arizal once broke into the Beit Midrash and he saw his students sitting there? He said, the Messiah is arriving in Jerusalem right now. We have to go right now. And his students jumped up and said, wait, I just have to tell my wife. And I have to pack my bags. And I have to. And he said, that's it. You missed it. Right? So there's two sides to that coin. There's two sides to that coin. You know, enthusiasm becomes over-enthusiasm. At the same time, a cool-headed realism is not what will bring redemption. So the power of Shabtai Tzvi also is driven by the fact that the conversos are his immediate enthusiasts, and they're distributed in every major port city of the world, much less the Jewish world. And they have the nasio. They already have a communication network between them, so they both believe, trust, and are in intimate contact with each other. They serve a very important role, as we'll speak about, as I can see at the end of our class, once Shabtai Tzvi is gone, in the creation of Sabbateanism, a movement based on his personality well after he's out of the way. For many of them, those years aren't over. Right? We'll talk about that mostly, I guess. I had planned on talking about Spinoza too, but you guys are just too involved. It's your fault, not mine. So let's just finish his story, and maybe we can throw Spinoza into the mix right at the end. So Shabtai Tzvi, he's bouncing around the sort of Ottoman Empire, and in 1662, after having declared this matir isurim, this philosophy of the abolition of the commandments, in 1662, he settles in Jerusalem. It seems at first, actually, in Jerusalem, that things were calm, that this was one of these periods in his life of a prolonged sort of a level nature to his personality. But the real turning point in his messianic career comes when word reaches him that a man of God had appeared in Gaza. Right? Ish Elohim, of course, is one of the terms that the Bible uses for a prophet. And that this man of God, like the Arizal before him, could actually look at your forehead and tell you your tikkun. He could tell you what exactly it was you needed to do for your final fixing in the world in order that your soul be made right. And Shabtai Tzvi was plagued by the sense that there was something wrong with his soul. Right? And so he went to Gaza in order to find this tikkun and what we would call peace of mind or peace of soul. And imagine what happens when Nathan of Gaza, which is who this personality was, looked at his soul and said, well, you're the Messiah. Yeah, it started to spread like wildfire from there. On the 17th of Sivan, Shabtai Tzvi publicly declared himself as the Messiah. He swept the entire community of Gaza, which at the time was a major Jewish community, including Yaakov Najara, who was a very important Kabbalist and rabbinic leader at the time. They marched on Jerusalem, riding, of course, a white horse. The sages of Jerusalem managed to sort of hold him out, but the masses were so with him that he circled the walls of the city seven times. Certain of the rabbis actually came over to him. They were so moved by the spectacle, right? And they led him into the city, but only for a brief amount of time. The sages of Jerusalem rallied and drove him out, but nothing slowed him down. At this point, Natan was both prophet and Elijah, right? Announcing the coming of the Messiah, sending out letters, and this is a very important part of the story, because who are these letters traveling with? Converso merchants, right? Like, who are swept up into this, and you can imagine that in one of his letters, when he says, oh, it's an amazing quote, actually it's a letter after So he sends out these letters, he declares the 17th of Tammuz, which today's practice a fast day. He declares it to be a feast. He annuls the fast. And in 1665, Natan wrote a letter to the entire Jewish world announcing not only that the final stage of redemption was at hand, but predicting the future. Predicting the future, he said that Shabtai Tzvi would take the crown from the Sultan without war, right? And after 4 or 5 years, he would go on to the river Sambatyon and bring back the 10 lost tribes, which was a very big notion amongst both Christian and Jewish mystics in its day, right? Things are looking good. He would put the Sultan in charge as his assistant, right? And things would roll from there. So, but the prime announcement he made was that the secret to which we are obligated by the Torah is that all of us must be anusim before we leave the galut. As it's written in the Torah, you shall serve other gods of wood and stone. Now, who anusim means forced converts, right? He's setting the stage for what comes next. Because at this point, the furor for the Mashiach was sweeping the Mediterranean in particular, also Europe. People are familiar with we'll get there, hang on. So the Chabad Tzvi goes up through Aleppo, and this is the first evidence we have of what's known as Sabbatean prophesying. People begin to speak in tongues and to collapse in his presence, dozens at a time, right? Ecstatic, messianic fervor. I got some great quotes here, but a revivalist atmosphere develops wherever he goes, which of course makes it extremely difficult for the rabbinic class to oppose him. If everybody's donning white, giving massive amounts of tzedakah, you know, confessing their sins and swearing they'll be good, it's kind of hard to stand up in shul and say, stop that, right? And this is exactly what's happening. He finally sails to Constantinople on December 30th, 1665, with the goal of taking the Sultan's crown. So word reaches Constantinople that he's on the way. He's intercepted by Turkish military, and he doesn't actually go to the capital. He's brought to a fortress on the European side of the Dardanelles, in Gallipoli. But this fortress becomes known as Migdal Oz, because he lives there like a prince. He begins to send letters out and receive delegations from all over Europe, including the two sons of Rav David Sigal, who's also known as the Taz, the Turi Zahav, one of the major rabbinic figures of the Council of the Four Lands. If you've ever learned the Shulchan Aruch, I promise you, you've learned the Taz. You can't learn it without it, right? The Taz sends his sons, who come and come back with a very enthusiastic report about the Messiah who is in prison. Things go downhill quickly in 1666 when a Polish Kabbalist, Nechemia HaKohen from Lvov, comes to see Shabtai Tzvi again on behalf of his community, another one of these delegations. However, an argument breaks out when he's there about who's the real Messiah, right? Because Nechemia HaKohen claims to be Mashiach ben Yosef, who's meant to precede, right, the sort of Mashiach ben David. Shabtai Tzvi says, oh no, you're not, right? Things don't go so well. And at a certain point, Nechemia turns to the Turkish guards and says, I'm ready to convert, take me to the Sultan. So that puts a lot of pressure on Shabtai Tzvi, who is then dragged before the Sultan and given the choice to take the sword or to convert, to take the turban, as it was called at the time. He chooses to don the turban rather than lose his hand, and he leaves the chamber of the Council of State as Aziz Mehmed Effendi. Now, you would think that this would be the end of Shabtai Tzvi's movement, but you would be wrong, because Natan Gaza doesn't stop preaching that doctrine that we already named, which is that everyone must be a forced convert. Everyone must enter into that darkest, most hidden place before redemption can come. See, there's no way you can fight.
Where did that come from?
That concept is, I would say, either logical or a perverted logic of the Ari's notion that the sparks are hidden in the world. And the physics goes right into the metaphysics. Something which falls from a highest place has the most potential energy, right? So it goes into the deepest depth. And you get the metaphysics of it as well, which is that the most powerful sparks of divine light are in the most hidden, dark places. I mean, by the way, it's a logical question, right? Why would God create, everything has a spark of life from God, according to the Arizal, according to many traditional Jewish thinkers. Nothing could exist without the divine light. And when you eat cow, what do you do when you eat that cow with the proper intention? You release the sparks that were in the meat. The very being of the cow is then able to serve God through your conscious action, through the act of slaughter, through the blessings that you make, through the mitzvot that you do with the energy you get from eating the meat. Amazing, yeah? What about pig? It doesn't work that way because it's asur. What does asur mean? What does it really mean? It means bound. Meaning, it's not that there's not sparks of godliness in that pig. It's just that you can't get at them. Well, wait. That means that there's some dark place in the world which remains to be redeemed. You hear this very appealing logic? Plus, by the way, it's hard to be a Jew. You're telling me I can do what I want? I can release all those boundaries that have kept me bound up for 1,500 years, and you'll give me a coherent philosophy? And you'll have a small but very enthusiastic group of people who have lived that in reality? The conversos? This is a powerful mix, right? And so therefore, even once Shabtai Tzvi converts, and he lives on for, I think, about another decade or so, I didn't write down exactly when he dies, it doesn't matter. It's all over. Because there are enthusiasts who become preachers already spreading Sabbateanism. Even today, there are a group of people in Turkey known as the Donme, who are the descendants of groups of Jews that followed Shabtai Tzvi to his victorious meeting with the Sultan. When they heard that he converted, they themselves also outwardly converted to Islam, because this was meant to be the last stage of redemption. Right? Just so you can appreciate the extent of the sort of the breakdown that comes here, is I'll tell you really briefly the story of the brothers Cardozo, and then I guess we're going to have to wait till next week to talk about Spinoza. We're going to reevaluate where we'll get to it all. So in 1648, two brothers, Miguel and Fernando Cardozo, fled Spain for Italy. They were amongst the actually Spanish conversos. When they reached Italy, they re-embraced Judaism, became Abraham and Isaac Cardozo. Isaac Cardozo became a leading rationalist and defender of Judaism. He wrote the Philosophica Libera. It's a very important work published in 1673 with the goal, we shall investigate nature and its founder so that from the world and its multitude of things, as if by a ladder, with enlightened and instructed mind, we may be lifted to God, its maker. Right? This is philosophical rationalism in a Jewish guise. And it's a very powerful... In 1673, we didn't get to Descartes, but philosophical rationalism is taking over the Christian world. Right? And Isaac Cardozo is one of its major proponents, and he was a master of the scientific and philosophical tools of his day, so he was good at using them to defend his faith. Meanwhile, just as he's trying to reconcile Judaism with rational philosophy, which will have its own consequences when we speak about the Enlightenment, right? His brother has become a Sabbatean prophet. Right? He's got the bug. Right? He was actually an enthusiast from the outset for Shabtai Tzvi in his lifetime. But once Shabtai Tzvi died and Isaac Cardozo began to mock this failed Messiah, seeing in his collapse a further support, by the way, that only rationalist philosophical approach will save Judaism from the darkness of a mythic messianism, Avram said, no, 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 this apostasy is actually an essential phase in the process of redemption, right? He says that, now listen, only a converso could write this. For the king Messiah wanted nothing other than to sanctify God's name. And thus he was anus. He was violated in every way and from every quarter. And the reason for our iniquities and the prime secret is that all of us must be, should sound familiar, anusim before we leave the galut. As is written in the Torah, you shall serve other gods of wood and stone. Right? That is exactly what he learned from Nathan of Gaza. But he didn't stop there, because he soon began to gather followers himself and declared himself a prophet and, soon enough, Messiah ben Joseph, which, by the way, is one of the symptoms of the whole Sabbatean movement we'll see over and over again. People begin as an enthusiast, become a Sabbatean prophet, and then themselves become convinced that they are the Messiah. And again, it may sound like just to us, like just unbalanced and crazy, but especially this notion of Mashiach ben Yosef is a very important role, and if we won't have the time to do it together, but next year, if we get to Zionism, we'll speak about the very interesting relationship between secular Zionism and this idea that there is a phase which paves the way in the practical world for redemption, right? And it is critical, and I guess we'll end on this note, to know that it's Avraham Kadosh who actually sort of crystallizes a couple of critical concepts in Sabbatean thought, and they're ones that will have a deep impact going forward in Jewish modernity. He says, in order to achieve the new Torah, there has to be some new Torah, because the Torah as it exists now will no longer be necessary. You have to do two things. You have to negate the religious and institutional forms in order to return to the original fountainheads of Jewish faith. Does that sound familiar to anyone? Negate the religious and institutional forms in order to return to the original fountainheads of the Jewish faith. There's another Jewish movement that will make that its driving impetus. Well, that was the earlier Christianity. I'm specifically referring to the early Reform movement, right? Which certain scholars will claim gained a lot of its philosophical impetus from Shabtai Tzvi, and if not directly, then indirectly in the failure of the rabbinic class to actually meet the needs. And never forget, in the end of the day, whatever the answer is of why Shabtai Tzvi had such a broad-scale movement, he was speaking to some real need. And it's an important thing to remember. If there are people out there in the world, I don't know, people in power who seem to be able to muster followings and you're not so happy about the way they do it, you might want to consider what is the need that's being met. Because if you focus on the person who's meeting the need, instead of asking the question, what need is being met, then I promise you, even if you succeed in getting rid of the person, another one will come along, because a need will be met. And so he says, number one, you have to negate this religious and institutional forms to return to the fountainheads of Jewish faith. And number two, he says that a critical piece of redemption is going to be casting off the yoke of exile and all involves. It's what's called in Hebrew, shlilat ha-galut. Interesting. Shlilat ha-galut becomes one of the watchwords of what? Zionism. This idea, and this is an important thing to recognize, is that the social revolution, combined with the Torah, the Rizal, and the collapse, as we're going to map it out, of the rabbinic class within Europe, and the shifting socioeconomic patterns, which will lead to both enlightenment and emancipation, will set the stage for all the hallmarks of Judaism going forward, for religious reform, for the emergence of secular thought, which we'll see next week in the person of Spinoza, for the rise of Jewish nationalism in the sort of guise of Zionism. And they're all rooted in many ways in the smoking crater that's left behind by the Sabbatean movement. So I think it's better to stop now on that note than to dray it out for another couple minutes. We'll pick up next week with Spinoza.
Thank you for downloading this podcast from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit almad.pardes.org.